fall.
I could hear this flying going on from the other side of the river. I couldn't actually see any members of the bridgehead platoon because of the distance. I could see from time to time Jap mortar bombs exploding, but not to the degree of clarity. And the next thing I recall is this. The area I was standing in was a wide area of paddy. And I saw, approaching me from the direction of the river, a group of our own chaps headed towards me. And I saw, as they got closer, they were led by Wingate himself. He looked just like a figure out of the Bible. He was there with his solar topi and a huge beard by this time. None of us had shaved since we left in Fowl. And he had a very impressive beard. And I say, he looked exceedingly biblical. As though it was yesterday, I can remember exactly just how he looked. His pack was bumping up and down on his back. He was moving at a fast trot. His eyes were wide and very staring. And as he passed me and my group, he cried out, "Disperse, disperse, get back to India." Those were his exact words. I can remember them to this day. I thought the man had gone stark, staring mad. Here we were, with a force of 700 strong, one platoon already across the river. He's not prepared to carry on with the crossing. I realised that we would have had casualties by persisting with the crossing, but we would have collected far fewer casualties than we eventually did by splitting up in small groups and getting back, trying to get back piecemeal to India. Well, what he had said in my hearing was to take place. Well, shortly after he had moved on from my position, 8th Column got the order to march. And we marched east, away from the Irrawaddy. Talk about the Grand Old Duke of York. That night, I got a warning order from Scotty. Probably Sergeant Major Cheevers brought it to me. That the mules and chargers were to be released and driven away the following day, as they might be a hindrance to us during our return to India. My parents had spent the Great War years in Yokohama. Their house was in Yokohama, and my father worked in Tokyo. He was in the insurance business, and then he was working for the China Mutual Insurance Company. And I remember as a small boy, my mother used to tell me stories of Japan, and I was fascinated by them. She told me about the people and the country, and she told stories exceedingly well. And I recall her telling me that she took a great fancy to the Japanese women, who were so nice, so kind, so good. She did not like the Japanese men. The thing she had against them was this: they were so cruel to animals, and she couldn't stand the way they treated their horses. Well, as my mother's stories in my mind, I thought, my God, what is going to happen to our mules and our chargers, who've done us so well? If we release them, the Japs will undoubtedly pick them up. They'll probably flog them to death. So I didn't fall asleep easily that night, thinking of the fate of our animals, and also thinking of the fate of the bridgehead platoon. And suddenly my charger, who was a great big red whaler, dark, dark chestnut, and my sights, there'll be a runner from the 6th Gurkhas who'd come with the draft referred to earlier in my story, had christened him Rati, which is the name our men have for the barking deer, to describe its colour. His actual name was Red Wagon, but we decided to use Dalvia's nickname, Rati. Rati started nuzzling my face, and Well, I was glad. It was dark, and no one could see. And the tears were running down my face. He, like all the other animals, had done me very well. He carried my pack the whole way from Imphal to now. To let him go the following morning, it's going to be absolutely great. Anyway, the following morning came, and I threw away my Cape oxygen bag, which I privately bought in Jhansi, and took a mesh-type blanket from the cotton stores. And I was carrying a 32-coat automatic, which I bought shortly before leaving the UK to go out to India. I was about to throw that away when Sergeant Ormondy came to me and asked if he could have it, so I gladly gave it to him. And he put it in his pack. And off we marched, leaving our mules and chargers where they had stood overnight. Only one wireless mule was taken, because we were hanging onto the wireless, I gathered, for quite some time to come. Many of our animals followed. We tried to drive them away and shoo them off. And mostly they went away without too much difficulty. But my beloved horse, he followed for hours. But he eventually left us in a high field of sugar cane. He turned round and went into the cane, and I saw his red rump disappear. And I looked round at my size now there. And he was weeping too. That night, there was much talk of our orders we'd received the following morning. And after our final airdrop, which had been arranged some days before, I gather. I spoke to Tag Sprague and I asked him if he would accompany me and my Gurkhas, his commander of the OAS, should we split up the following day. And much to my great relief, he agreed. So we had the final airdrop of 10 days' rations this time, and I was called to my first O group. It was a big day. Confirmation was that all columns were split up into small groups. Wingate had played us his last ace card. He'd taken us so far, but he wasn't going to take us back. And for that, I've never forgiven him. The single radio set would go with Scotty's group. And Scotty had asked us if we would let him have, as soon as we could, our chosen routes back to India, or to China. So that before we split up, he could issue us with maps. So Tag and I duly told him that we would go north to the Awari, where it ran east-west between the two big villages of Bamo and Katha, and cross there, and then once we were over, we'd head west for the Chindri. Tag and I took our set of maps and compasses, and I remembered so clearly map reading session at Bangalore, where I'd been sent round a bazaar on a bicycle. Now, in the middle of a wilderness, I was required to take my small group of ill-trained Gurkhas over hundreds of miles of hostile territory, in hospital terrain, and through the hunting parties of the Jap 33 Division. All through my story, I referred to the enemy as being the 33 Division. That is the story I was talking about at the beginning of this interview. However, to my surprise and interest, in 1990, I was shown a translated copy of a document issued by Lieutenant General Renio Mutaguchi's 15th Army headquarters, then stationed in Mainil, of his assessment of Wingate's expedition. And in addition to making brief reference to casualties inflicted on Wingate's division, such as, or Wingate's brigade, such as 30 killed here, 15 killed there, 20 killed elsewhere, in the area of the Irrawaddy River, it didn't tell us a great deal, or didn't tell me a great deal, of what the Japs had achieved against us. However, what I did find interesting was that not only were 33 divisions in the field against us, but 18 and 56 divisions were there as well, hunting for us and trying to stop us getting back alive to India. Had I known this at the time, that we had the equivalent of a British corps in the field against us, I'd have had kittens. Now, we knew the Japs would make every effort to prevent our escape. It was, therefore, for me, an immense undertaking, and it's not surprising, perhaps, that I should be critical of Wingate's training methods and his battle tactics. I think he took us one river too far. I had, of course, grave doubts about my own ability to lead my men back to safety. But in those dark and frightening months that lay ahead, Tag Sprague was to prove to be my rod and my staff. I was very touched when, just before we left 8th Column, Sergeant Ormley and his groom Hand, Private Hand, both came to ask if they would accompany me and my Gurkhas. Naturally, I gave my permission with much pleasure. I felt sure they'd want to go back with their own friends and their own platoons, but no, they wanted to come with me. And so in the early part of the first week in April, Tag and I and my 52 Gurkhas, plus a dozen or so BORs, split from 8th Column. Before leaving, I packed 10 days' rations into my pack, and when I put it on, its weight absolutely staggered me. I was still then fit and strong, but it was a hell of a weight, and I thought to myself, bloody hell, how earth am I going to carry this all the way back to India? But carry it I had to, and carry it I did. I was given from Scotty's column treasure chest 400 rupees in silver rupee pieces, and I put these in a basic pouch on my belt. I wasn't wearing braces, but I couldn't adjust the belt and two pouches on either side, and they weighed a ton, incredibly heavy. So I had my heavy pack and this heavy pouch of silver rupees there to contend with, and I was cursing my luck. But in those days, for us, the pack carried a man's lifeblood, and he who threw it away was being very, very foolish indeed. It carried our food, our bedding, all our bits and pieces, and it was the most important part of our equipment. So we marched away with very mixed feelings from 8th Column. The Kings had given my men a very warm welcome. They'd looked after us well, and they'd treated us well in every way. And they thanked us for our services. But now, on our own, our responsibilities have become very great indeed. And never again, throughout my whole combat severing, was I to face a greater test. So for us, this was it then. Our escape to freedom was to begin. But so was the waking nightmare, which was to torment me from that day on, and which had become more and more frightening as days, weeks, months go by. No time. We set off in a northerly direction now to recross the vast Irrawaddy where it flows east-west. And each escape group had been given half a dozen or so soldiers from the Burma Rifles Reconnaissance Platoon. And we'd been most fortunate, been given an exceptional NCO, a young Naik called Tun Tin, who was a Karen, like the other soldiers in this Burma Rifles platoon. He was mission school educated, and he spoke excellent English. Sadly, as my story will tell, he wasn't to stay with us very long. It must have taken us about 3 days or so to reach the Irrawaddy now. It is flat country, and we are fearful of detection. If we were seen, some unfriendly villagers could so easily alert the Japs, and there were many Jap bases in the immediate area. Before we'd left, Scotty had given us a list of all known bases, known villages which held Jap soldiers or headquarter bases. So at least we knew where to avoid, but there was still the chance of somebody spotting us and reporting us, and we might be ambushed. Well, eventually we reached the village of Zibugon on the Irrawaddy, and we sent Tuntin and a few of his Berber riflemen dressed in civilian clothes. They all carried civilian clothes in their packs. They could reconnoiter in reasonable safety. We asked them to go to see the headman and see if they could ascertain whether the villagers were friendly and whether they were prepared to help us by hiring us boats. But eventually he came back and he reported that the villagers were indeed friendly. There was a Jap present at Schwegu, which Scotty had told us about. This was a big village about 12 miles to the southeast of Zibugon. And he, the headman, promised to give us early warning should Japs approach his village. We were very comforted to hear that, of course, and as a counter to that, so to speak, we were disappointed to be told it would take a day or so before the headman could collect sufficient boats to ferry us and our party over the river. So we had to wait very anxiously on a reed-covered sandbag, the sandbank, rather. And while we were waiting there, I remember the sour trees were in blossom, and they gave the most incredible scent out, and it was just like a wet flannel. And this smell of the wet flannel blossoms of the sour trees remains me in my memory to this day. Well, we waited and waited and waited, and it was early on the night of the 11th, 12th April, 43, that four or five large boats arrived. And after one boat, boatmen had done a reconnaissance of the far bank, which I thought was a very sensible idea of the headman, and it enabled us to cross the river in a much happier frame of mind than we might otherwise have done. Tag and I recall it must have taken us half an hour or so to get across. It was quite quick, much quicker than we imagined it would be, bearing in mind the slow crossing we had on our outward journey across the Ertigang. And I noticed the sandbanks that we encountered in the river were not in the same positions. They were marked on our maps. And then I realised, of course, the monsoon rains would cause them to move. And as our maps were made in 1910, and this was 1943, it was understandable that they should have been in places other than that indicated by our maps. We must have disembarked on the other side about 2000 hours. No, perhaps it was about 2000 hours that we embarked into the boats. We must have got across round about 2100 hours on the far side. It was roughly that time of the night anyway. And we then paid and thanked the boatmen and moved off that night, northeast for some 4-5 miles or so to some high ground, which we saw from our maps was jungle covered. We reckoned it was safe to base up there for the night. We posted our sentries and slept for what was left of the night. I must say I felt terribly elated that we crossed that first huge barrier and we were on our way home. But we had one more major river, of course, to cross, and that was the Chingrin, and many more smaller rivers in between that. And I reckon probably, as the crow flies, we must have got about 200 miles to go to reach the Chingrin, And as the soldier marched, of course, it'd be much longer. And the monsoon was due to break late May, early June, so we had no time to lose. And the minor rivers between our present position and the Chilwin could, after heavy rain, become tremendous barriers for us. So we had to get a wiggle on and move cautiously, but at best speed. The following day, the 12th of April, we're on the march again, northwest this time for 2 days, I think it was, to Kokwe Chang. That was a north-south flowing river which drained into the Irrawaddy some 5 miles further south, and not far from where we'd actually crossed the big river on the night of the 11th, 12th. We now must march perhaps some 25 miles since crossing the Irrawaddy. We crossed the Kokwe Chang, which is about 25 to 30 yards wide, with steep 12-foot-high banks, and the water was waist-deep. On the west bank of the Kokwe, I sent Tun Tin and his Burma rifleman, in civilian dress again, to recce the village of Tha Ta, which is some two miles to our south. We followed them fairly closely, in case they got into trouble. And a short while later, Tun Tin sent back some scouts to report that the village was clear and we'd get a warm welcome. So, on receiving his report, we moved as quickly as possible into the village and begged the head man for rations, which he gladly agreed to supply. This is now the early morning of the 14th of April. We've got half an hour to collect the rice before we wanted to move on. We got a few chickens and a sock full of rice per man. I had a very sore toe since before we crossed the Irrawaddy, so I thought I'd sit in my pack and take my boot off for the first time and see what is what. And when I took my sock off, I found I'd got a huge quicho type abscess in my right toe, on the big toenail. And I just didn't know what to do with it. We got no medicine at all, nothing to help any such poisonous ailments, and I decided the only thing to do was to put my boot on and hope for the best. As I was putting my boot on, Tag came up and stood over me and said, "Don't worry, old boy, we get you back to India." I told him a sore toe was going to stop me, but in my own mind, I was a bit concerned because in our deteriorating physical condition, I thought that such an infection might get worse and worse, and I could be, in a while, unable to march. Anyway, all will be well in a moment, as I shall reveal the dough. Once we distributed the rations, we were ready to move, and we marched out of the village. But just before we did so, I saw a villager get on a bicycle and move out of the village along the track we were about to take, and pedal out of our sight. I paid no heed to this. So we continued our move off out of the village. We're now marching north along a narrow track with the Kokwe Chang, which we'd recently crossed, to our right. I had about two or three Gurkhas ahead of me, with Tag, Tun Tin, Sergeant Dolmody and his groom hand, and the others to my rear. If I may, I'll read now from my story what happened. I didn't think we'd gone very far from the village when, totally out of the blue, an ambush exploded abruptly to my immediate left. I can remember roaring out to my men, "Dali Thirusup, take cover right," while diving for cover myself into the bushes to the right of the track. Things happened very quickly in an ambush. Hundreds of thoughts flashed through the minds of those caught in this way, and all in the briefest of seconds. I remember that I wasn't actually frightened, which surprised me, I was totally and utterly shocked. Never ever during any of my previous training had I been taught any of the approved contact drills. Certainly the counter-ambush drills are known to me. I was utterly appalled to realize that I simply did not know what to do in order to extract my men and myself from my present predicament. My earlier inadequate training chickens have now come home to roost with vengeance. The Jap gunner was firing his LMG immediately opposite me from the jungle on the far side of the track. He was so close that I could clearly see the smoke rising from his gun's muzzle. His bursts of fire were hitting the trees and bushes above my head. The bullets were cutting the branches and bits of leaf and wood were falling on my pack, on my neck, and down my shirt collar. There was also rifle fire coming from the enemy lying to the left and right of the light machine gunner. I think, but I'm not absolutely certain, that another LMG was also fired at my men who had been behind me on the track. Altogether, my impression was that the enemy ambush was not of any great length. I now know that, with subsequent experience gained later in the war and during the Malayan emergency, I could have rolled up such an ambush without too much difficulty and killed the enemy or put him to flight. On that hot morning, though, lying immobilized outside the village of Thar Tar, such remedial action was quite beyond me. I don't know how long I lay there under the blanket machine gun fire before taking such action as I did. It cannot have been very long, perhaps a minute and a half, no more. I remembered hearing the Jap gunner change one magazine before my mind registered properly a fraction of a second later on what I had just heard. I said to myself, the next time I heard them change the magazine, I must go and get out of it, get clear of the ambush killing ground. In the meantime, I tried to raise my rifle to fire at the place where I assumed the gunner to be. I was in a prone position, with my freshly filled and heavy pack on my back. The pack's weight kept my head down so low and so close to the ground that I couldn't see properly along the barrel or through the sights of my bolt-action single-shot weapon. To pull off single, unaimed shots from ground level at the Jap gunner would merely give him a clear pointer to my position, when he could have lowered his aim and fired his burst much closer to the ground, and then, of course, I'd have been in real trouble. I thought to myself then, dear God, if only I were armed with a Tommy gun instead of this damned old rifle, I could fire bursts from my prone position without looking through the sights and stand a good chance of knocking out a Jap gunner. Then I heard him change magazines for the second time. There was no time to lose. I roared above the noise of the continuing rifle fire, "Samjanot! Everybody up! Meropachiaja! Follow me!" I leapt to my feet as fast as my heavy pack would permit and turned away the track and crashed through the jungle, calling to my men to follow the whole time I was running. To have stayed any longer, lying there in the Jap's killing ground, would have been to court disaster. In the light of our lack of knowledge of counter-ambush drills, I looked around me. Some of my men were running parallel with me, some were Tag's men, some were my own. There was no sign of Tag, or Ormsby, or Tuntin. Then I saw one of my lance snakes, turn 75-13, Kambasharai. I noticed his khaki trouser leg was bloody. "Oh, 13, I cried out to him. "Where have you been hit?" He called back, "Here in the thigh, sir." I shouted to him again, "Can you run?" He said, "I can." So I told him to carry on running after me. We set off together then, with Kambasha following behind me. My men were running to my flanks and started to close.